Hi everyone, this is Dr. Cheryl Selman and welcome to What Women Must Know. Thank you for joining me for another opportunity to really have an enlightening and in-depth conversation about topics that are really important to know about. I always say that this show is about empowering you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible. And I was just recently reading a definition of empowerment, which is providing resources. So when you have resources available to you, you're able to take action appropriately. And this is what we're doing, is giving you the knowledge that will give you the resources that will provide you the opportunity to make the best choices possible. And as always, I invite you to go to my website, whatwomenmustknow.com, because if you opt in there and if you haven't yet visited the website, I have these special reports that you get as soon as you opt in. I have numerous articles, lots of great information gets sent to you. And also my Facebook page, which is the same name, What Women Must Know, is a place where I do a lot of posting of great information, research, a variety of things that I come across that I think would really be beneficial to you. So take advantage of the opportunity to learn, to get educated, and to keep moving forward in your life with that greater awareness. More than ever, we need to be able to access truthful information. And on that note, we're going to be talking about understanding and getting the truth about estrogen. We have lots of information about estrogen. Estrogen comes up a lot when we talk about women's health, when we talk about the risk and incidence of breast cancer, even prostate cancer. Estrogen is a really big story, but so few of us really understand what that means. What kind of role does estrogen play in our health? What is the real issue with estrogen in relationship to increased incidence of breast cancer? What about exposure to estrogens from the environment or from hormone replacement, bioidentical hormone replacement, the pill? What is really happening when we are exposed to estrogens, and how does our body manage it? And how does estrogen transform from being one of the most important hormones to support our health and well-being to becoming a molecule, a hormone that can increase our risk of chronic illnesses? A big topic, one that I'm really interested in and have been researching. And to help us understand more about estrogen, I have invited Dr. Michael Nelson to be with us. Dr. Michael Nelson is a chiropractic physician. He has been practicing functional medicine for over 22 years. He is the founder and director of Sierra Tahoe Wellness Center in Reno Lake Tahoe area. His practice focuses on establishing optimal wellness and health strategies for his patients based on the most up-to-date scientific evidence and the innate wisdom of our bodies. He has successfully treated thousands of patients over the course of his career in an integrated and holistic manner. Identifying and treating estrogen metabolism is a primary focus of his treatment strategies for both men and women. Dr. Nelson has worked with the world's top researchers, physicians, and scientists in bringing cutting-edge treatments from bench to bedside. And he has worked for 9 years in the neonatal intensive care and ICU setting prior to receiving his doctorate degree in 1993 from the University of Western States in Portland, Oregon. Dr. Nelson has advanced training in functional endocrinology, neurology, orthopedic rehabilitation, gastroenterology, herbal medicine, and integrative cancer treatment. So there is no better person to help us understand this estrogen metabolism story than Dr. Michael Nelson. And it's my great pleasure to invite him to the show today. Hello, Dr. Nelson.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, I'm thrilled that you can be here. We have met at one of the integrative conferences in New York City several months ago. We've had several conversations since then, and I'm really so thrilled you can be here because you are such a font of wisdom, and particularly in this topic we're going to be talking about today, estrogen metabolism, that I've been looking forward to our conversation, and I know it will be quite an enlightening conversation for everyone. So great. Let's just jump right into things, and maybe we need to just start by explaining a bit about hormones and what is estrogen and what role does estrogen play in our health for women and for men?
Okay, great. Yeah, so before I just jump right in, you gave a nice introduction on what I do and how I do it. And I think it's important to understand how I actually got to where I got interested in hormone disruption and hormone patterns in the body. And it all started back in my undergrad days when I was actually working as a level 3 neonatal intensive care nursery. And during that process, I became acutely aware of the amazing benefits of modern science and the modern medicine in its application to saving lives and to really seeing the ability to take these very premature babies and actually have them survive. And during that process, I gained a really keen understanding of the mother's role in the development of the fetus and the hormonal milieu that would course throughout the body during fetal development. And then more importantly, a lot of these children that we were seeing were babies that were either had in vitro fertilization or they had some type of fertility help during the process of conception. And so that piqued my interest way back. This is over 30 years ago. And as I started to gain some understanding and interest in this topic, it just migrated all the way through my doctorate training. And in 1991, I was fortunate enough to start to follow the founder of functional medicine, which is Dr. Jeffrey Bland. He's somebody that I would consider to be my hero. And people that are in the functional medicine arena know who Dr. Jeff Bland is. And he actually really started to put together this concept, this idea that our bodies work as a systems biology. And the systems biology approach needs to be looked at from the moment that we even think about having a baby or the moment that we think about passing on our genetic lineage to how we manage that genetic lineage over the course of the rest of our lifespan. And so with that kind of context of me moving into understanding how a number of different environmental influences can play a role, both endogenously, our estrogen and hormonal status, to the exogenous status that can be placed upon us through the environmental influences. I started to really see the detriment and also the benefit that managing these pathways can have. So estrogen or hormone balancing has been at the forefront of my practice since the very beginning of private practice in 1993 when I first set up. And I was always interested in it because when patients would come to see me, they would be complaining of a multitude of different symptoms that would manifest in a number of different systems that would always have some role of hormone imbalance. There's always some hormonal process that could be linked back to an expression of a certain symptom. And with that, I started to delve into testing and managing and reading and researching, and the journey really to this day has not stopped. And the foundation of estrogen or hormones is something that we all need to be aware of because of so much of what's taking place right now in the environment. And as we become more and more exposed to environmental influences through our lifespan, we start to see that we become more and more burdened with hormonal imbalances. And so I don't know if that's answering your question, but I wanted to kind of give you some background information on how I ended up being where I'm at.
Well, yeah, it's so fascinating, which I didn't know all of that history. I wanted to ask you, since you were talking about your experience with neonatal care and these children born through women who went through fertility issues, did you see any greater risk to the health of the mother or the baby going through fertility treatments, which many treatments use high amounts of estrogen to help women super ovulate? And there are some problems and risks associated with that. Did you notice any of that when you were working in that setting?
Yeah, I don't know if it was directly related to the hormone replacement, but the question that I always asked was, why were they not able to conceive? And I had to reflect back on that as I gained more understanding. And you know, I've always had a system of nature is something that is there for its own a purpose. And when we start to move things away from what nature's intended purpose is, there's unintended consequences as a result of that. And whether that's, you know, premature labor or premature birth or premature development in utero. I think that those things are all unintended consequences when we start to force the hand of having somebody conceive when they might not be ready. So I think that, you know, if I look back, I would say, yeah, there is some impact that the hormone replacement or the hormone inductions had on allowing mothers to conceive. Or maybe they weren't quite ready, or maybe they just weren't a good match for conception at the time. And so that took place later in my understanding of systems biology, because when you're in the midst of a NICU, those questions really are not too pertinent to what you're doing, because you're really right there to save lives, right, and to, you know, manage the acuity of the situation.
I just actually asked that as a kind of an aside of what we're doing, because when I was doing research for my books, I actually met women who had IVF treatments, and they were put on Clomid and other forms of estrogen, and as a result created thyroid imbalances. Some women later found that they had a breast cancer incidence related to the exposure. And also I came across a statistic that said 25% of children born through IVF mothers had some sort of health problem issue as a result of kind of a natural environment that initiated it. So it was really fascinating to learn about some of these risks that women are not really being told much about. So anyway, you know, in the world of estrogen, when I was investigating hormones, which I didn't know much about initially, I was astounded to learn how potent they are. And correct me if I'm wrong here, but I remember coming across information that said estrogen is found in parts per trillion. So that means that you just need a teeny little amount of this hormone, which is then going throughout the entire body, affecting every single cell through receptor sites, with just a teeny, 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 minuscule amount of that hormone can have huge, huge effects. And that's when it's in balance. So is that true, is that an accurate kind of amount? Is like part estrogen is made in parts per trillion? Do you know anything about that?
Oh yeah. So I tell I lecture regularly on this, and the concept that I like to get people to understand is that we measure these things in nanograms and picograms, and these are millionths and billionths or trillionths of concentrations. And the analogy might be is if we had a huge rail car full of popcorn, and we wanted to add some salt that would allow that popcorn to have enough salt to taste good. That rail car full of popcorn would be, I would take a pinch of salt, and that would be the equivalent of having enough salt or estrogen in the system to do its job. And so these concentrations of hormones are extremely low, but extremely potent and powerful.
And I think that really needs to be understood and emphasized, and why when we get into the topic of estrogens and estrogen exposure, it can play such havoc because it is so potent a hormone, and we are having a variety of sources that are increasing these estrogen levels in our body with consequences. So when we talk about estrogens, we talk about chemicals being estrogenic. Can you help people understand what that means? And when we say a chemical like bisphenol is an estrogen, does it look exactly to the body like an estrogen? And how is it impacting the body?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a really relevant question that we should all be asking on a regular basis when we look at exposure and overburdening the system with chemicals that could be mimicking the effect of estrogen and vying for the same pathways of metabolism of estrogen. And so when we look at chemistry, there's this concept of structure and function. And structure would indicate that the structure of the molecules would be similar. And when molecules have similar structure, they often have similar binding coefficients or binding capacity. And what do I mean by that? Well, if I've got something that has a very similar structure and it fits into a key, or fits into a lock, and this is the key that fits into the lock, it's going to bind to that particular structure on the cell and activate or maybe inactivate or block the body's ability to receive the message, or it may turn on the body's ability to receive the message. And that process is initiated and started through the structural similarity of the molecule. And so we know that there's molecules that are, we're literally swimming in a sea of estrogen. And this is called xenohormesis, foreign hormesis, or foreign substances that are having a hormetic or a homeostatic effect on our body. And so our body's always sensing these molecules at a structural level that gets manifested down into the cellular level, because they'll bind to that same site that maybe estrogen might be vying for and either turn it on or disrupt it and interfere with it. And so these things have to be looked at from an environmental perspective, because as I said, that little pinch of salt is powerful enough to make that entire rail car full of popcorn salty. And if we're swimming in a sea of these, what we would call endocrine disrupting chemicals, then our body is really starting to shift its physiological set point out of balance. And there's going to be adaptive processes that will take place that we may not want. And so it's important for us to understand that these molecules don't necessarily have to be identical. They only have to be similar. And the similarity is what really triggers the reaction in the body to create some of these unwanted side effects that we might be seeing.
And here's a little interesting factoid that I came across. When in the early 30s or so, 30s or 40s, when they were researching hormones and the application of hormones and what could be sources for hormones like estrogen, they actually were researching bisphenol A, which is, of course, a chemical that we find leaching into water from water bottles or from the lining of tin cans or now from receipts from supermarkets that are created from heat. This chemical was initially considered to be a chemical that could be used as a form of estrogen for estrogen replacement. And so it's such a similar molecule that they were even considering at some point using bisphenol A for estrogen treatments, which they decided they weren't going to do. But, it just kind of emphasizes the point. You know, this is powerful. These chemicals are powerful to the body and act as our own estrogens would.
Right. Yeah, you're exactly right. Bisphenol A was actually initially formulated and synthesized as a pharmaceutical drug. And this is back many, many decades ago. And then it actually showed it was too powerful, so they didn't want to use it. So somehow it got incorporated into the polymer world, which is where you find it with the receipt paper today, and then you find it in the lining of all cans. And I first became aware of the impact that this was having when I formulate products for various companies, and they'll hire me as a product formulation expert. And I formulated a number of different beverages that have been out on the market. And I had to work with the can companies to do what's called accelerated corrosion testing, where we'll take the substance that we're going to be putting, the liquid that we're going to be putting inside the can, send them aliquots of the substance and with known pHs and known ingredients and all that, send them to the can company. The can company would then, this is, people like Rectam and Ball, the number one, these are the largest can suppliers in the world. Those are the ones that you see all the energy drinks with, and those are the ones you see all the sodas with, and all the, even the natural stuff that you're seeing out there. If it's a can, it's probably coming from one of those two companies. So they have to be sent the substance that they're going to be putting in there for corrosion testing. And at first, I didn't understand it. I said, well, okay, we'll send it to them. I've been doing this for a while. And then I started asking questions. They go, well, what are you doing when you're doing this accelerated corrosion testing? And they go, oh, we're just trying to figure out how much liner to put on the can or in the can. I go, liner? And I go, what do you put in there? And then they started telling me, and it's a number of different chemicals, but one of the components and part of the composition of the polymer that lines the can is bisphenol A, BPA. Now, what they try and do is they have to put enough lining in the can in order for it to exceed, shelf life by 12 months. So a typical beverage has a shelf life of around 6 months to 12 months. So they need to have enough in there, enough lining in there, so that if it goes outside that date, there's another year's worth of liner that will be eroded and leached into the substance that you're drinking, so that you don't end up leaching the aluminum into the substance because they think that's very toxic. So in the meantime, you're drinking, from the moment that product goes into the can, it is leaching out these chemicals into the substance that you're going to be drinking, whatever that is. And they've very clearly shown now that, for instance, in men that drink sodas and have exposures to bisphenol A, their sperm count is significantly lower and their testosterone levels are significantly lower as a result. And there's a direct relationship to this. And so these endocrine disrupting chemicals are in all of us, and you're getting much higher exposures the more you consume these types of products. And so we have to be aware of that And I think the big thing now that's coming out is, you know, even some of these BPA-free polymers are also very endocrine, have a large amount of the endocrine disrupting chemicals in them as well. So we have to kind of start to open up our eyes to, you know, where are we getting the exposure, and how do we minimize the exposures?
And it's become so ubiquitous, like you said, we all have these toxic chemicals of bisphenol A in our system. And I just have to say, I was always surprised to learn that dental sealants, which is, you know, you take your little kids to get your teeth protected and they put these dental sealants on them. Guess what? Bisphenol A is in those dental sealants leaching into these kids' bodies, not without consequences. And, you know, one of the areas of research that I've been doing and writing had to do with precocious puberty. So one out of six eight-year-olds, I think that's still a statistic, one out of six eight-year-olds are going into puberty now. And we have to acknowledge that part of what's driving this early, kind of unfolding into puberty is related to these early exposures to all these estrogens and all the sources we've talked about, which is pretty shocking, because the earlier a child is going through puberty, the greater their lifetime risk will be of hormonal imbalances, infertility, and of course breast cancer. So,
yeah.
There's a term that I've heard, I'm sure you've heard of it too, that estrogen is the angel and estrogen can be the devil. You know, it just depends how the amounts that we're exposed to and when and how it's processed. And so, you know, estrogen is a really big story and we need to understand it. And we all are now familiar with a term called estrogen dominance, which is recognized that we are generally experiencing an excess of estrogen, much higher levels than we should be, and it puts all the other hormones out of balance. So it can bring progesterone down, it can bring our thyroid down, it can increase insulin, it can increase cortisol levels. Everything starts going out of whack when one critical hormone is out of balance. Can you comment further about that?
Yeah. It goes back to the systems biology approach, and a system has to work in harmony with the other elements that are in the system. So if you a fish tank is a great example. A fish tank, if we start to see algae starting to grow inside that fish tank, the entire environment of that fish tank starts to shift and change, and then the consequence is that the health of the organisms that are living inside that are all going to be subjected to the impact that that particular environmental stimulus is having on the species that are living inside there. So if we take hormones, for example, and we look at the impact that hormones have on our body when they're in balance, it's quite pleasant. It's beautiful. It's harmonious. It helps to maintain the vital essence of who we are and maintain the integrity of who we are in a number of different ways, physically, chemically, psychically, or emotionally. And then when these hormones start to shift out of balance because one starts to own the physiology, then all of the hormones have to react in such a way to adapt to that one particular dominant feature, or maybe the lack of that. For instance, if you have a hysterectomy, then you start to see a shift in all the hormones as a compensatory mechanism, because they work in harmony and like an orchestra, like a symphony. And if you've ever been to an orchestra, and you watch them when they're first warming up, it's discordant. There's nothing taking place. And it's like, wow, I hope they start to sound better. And then the conductor, which is typically your brain, when the conductor gets up there and taps on the podium and taps on the area where he's getting ready to conduct, and everybody stops, and then everybody gets ready, and then he starts waving his wand, and everybody's playing at the same tempo with the same music, and it's a beautiful sound that can be made. And yet, if you've ever had, I've got three kids, so, and they all have been playing music. So if you've ever gone to their recitals and you've watched, you've sat through the recitals, you can hear that they just haven't quite got it yet. And then as they progress with their abilities, they start to sound a lot better. And that's how your body works, too. So we have to have a harmonious relationship with all the hormones, because when one's out of balance, they all have a tendency to move out of balance as well.
So that was great, a great explanation. Thanks for that. And I want us to talk about this concept called estrogen metabolism. People may have heard of it, but I don't think it's really fully understood, nor the implications of what happens when estrogen is metabolized through the liver, and what needs to go on, and what are the risks if it is not properly metabolized. So this is a really big topic, so we're going to spend some time and help people really understand this.
Sure. All hormones have to be metabolized and eliminated. And estrogen is no exception, and neither is testosterone or progesterone. They're all metabolized. And the reason estrogen becomes such an important metabolic pathway, or the ability to metabolize estrogen, is because when it's left only partially or unmetabolized, it can set the stage for what one might consider as the oncogenic potential, this potential for developing unwanted side effects to tissue in the body. And primarily estrogen, maybe estrogen-sensitive tissue, even though all tissue has an estrogen receptor on it, but the tissue that seems to be the most highly involved in improper estrogen metabolism are the breast, uterus, ovaries, and actually colon. So all these tissues can start to have a negative impact if we're not able to take estrogen from its initiating set point and pull it all the way through the body and eliminate it. And there's a lot of things that can get in the way of the ability to metabolize estrogen properly. And it goes back to what we first started talking about, is if we're exposed to an overabundance of estrogen-like molecules that have similar characteristics in their structure, they also vie for the exact same metabolic pathways for metabolism as your own endogenous estrogen. And as those estrogens come into the system, then the metabolic pathways become overburdened, and they can no longer handle the amount of, or the volume of estrogen or estrogen-like molecules to metabolize, and we start to backlog the metabolism, or we're unable to completely metabolize it, and we get stuck halfway, which can be the most damaging and the most deleterious aspect of it.
So let's talk about what happens when you are trying to deactivate these estrogen molecules in whatever form they may be found. They may come from the bisphenol A's or other toxic chemicals. They may come from the use of the pill or hormone replacement of one sort or another, be it bioidentical or your, you know, more pharmaceutical HRT, or even from our own production of estrogen, which happens in both men and women, and of course from the fat cells. So the more we are carrying visceral fat, that belly fat, that becomes another source of estrogen. So all these estrogens have to be deactivated through the liver. And what happens when we don't have the right enzymes in place to complete this process?
Well, that's the crux of the conversation, right? Is how do we actually take these estrogen compounds and get them out so that they're not going to create any problems or backlog or interfere with other hormonal elements in the body? And then how do we deal with the aging process? And then how do we deal with the variation in metabolism from one person to another? And so the liver does play a primary role. And I like to tell my patients that, you know, there's two ways to do it. There's you need to reduce exposure and improve elimination. Those are the basics, right? So we want to reduce as much of the exposure as we can. We can't live in a bubble, but, you know, we can choose what kind of foods that we're eating, and we can choose what kind of carpet that we put in our house and what kind of paint that we put in our house and what kind of food or drink that we're consuming and exposing ourselves to. So we have some control over this. So the liver is key in the whole process, but the liver is set up with another detoxification pathway called the cytochrome P450 pathway. And that pathway is what can really create a lot of the problems for the liver if the liver isn't ready to bind and eliminate the metabolite that takes place as a result of you partially metabolizing estrogen. And this is where it gets interesting, because tissue, extra hepatic tissue, tissue that's not liver tissue, has its own endogenous detoxification processes in place. And so we know that in breast tissue is primarily fat tissue, it's got some enzymes. One of the enzymes is called aromatase. And aromatase will activate some of the estrogens and create some problems that we don't want to have. And fat tissue becomes the largest tissue to produce your estrogen after you stop having cycles. So if you have more fat tissue, you have more estrogen. And if you have more estrogen, then you have to have more capabilities to clear the estrogen. And that includes the liver as well as the cytochrome P450. So here's what's interesting is if we do biopsies of breast tissue that is has cancer in it, we can see, and they've done the studies where they've shown that the tissue that they biopsies that has cancer in it can have 50 to 100 times more estrogen in situ where that tumor was than in the serum when we draw it from the blood. And so these little biofactories start to create their own cellular environment that then starts to stimulate the change in cellular metabolism, and it actually damages the genetics or the DNA of the local tissue. And that's what starts to set the stage for the cancer that we see, whether it's in, you know, uterus, breast, prostate, colon. These are all areas that create their own microenvironment from DNA damage that takes place as a result of oftentimes a hormonal impact in the local environment. And so that's where it starts to become really important for having a strong, healthy liver that can bind these intermediates, these activated estrogens that need to be pulled and cleared from the body in a regular, very robust fashion at times. And so the liver becomes the rate-limiting organ system in the body to allow for the estrogens to be completely and fully cleared out of the system.
So that's, you know, this is so profound. So let me just say the reason why I even want to have this conversation has to do with the fact that in the 3 years that I've been using nutrigenomic testing, which I've done various shows on, I found that there are certain inherited genomic tendencies, I call them the software of the DNA, that can be altered through environment, that up to, I would say, more than 95% of people I've tested, and tested about 300 people so far, So that's my sample. About more than 95% of people have inherited instructions for the clearance of estrogen that is impaired. So the signal, the communication isn't fully functioning, which means it impairs the liver's ability to take estrogen and turn it into this deactivated benign form that can be taken out. And therefore, it's not just that. It also then tends to convert it into this more reactive, dangerous form. It kind of takes estrogen and transforms it into the most dangerous molecule you can make from estrogen. And that then is what is occurring in the breast tissue, as well as other sites in the body, being a major factor that can drive breast cancer. And not only can drive breast cancer, but can lead to other problems, and we can talk about how men are affected, but also it's like something we've inherited, and it's always present unless it's supported. So women who've had breast cancer are still at risk unless you address it for recurrence of breast cancer or even uterine cancer or prostate cancer or even just excessive amounts of estrogen as a result of this impaired ability to deactivate estrogen into a safe form rather than turning it into a more potent and dangerous form. Is that an accurate assessment of things from your perspective? Because I think we really want people to understand this. It's so big. It's so huge. And, you know, we're having this conversation, but it doesn't happen very often that we can have and hear this kind of information.
No, you're exactly right. There is a there's a genetic uniqueness in everybody, and it's not your destination to be cursed with the outcome. The knowledge that you gain from like a nutrigenomic test or a estrogen metabolism test allows you to have the information to support the process of elimination at the level that you need it. And even more important than that is that we need to always understand that your ability to take molecules in and out can vary a thousandfold from person to person and from time to time and varies throughout your entire life cycle. And that's another key element too that needs to be understood is just because you have the understanding that, well, I've got good metabolism at the time we did the test, that doesn't mean that your system can't be overburdened with or backlogged with estrogen metabolites that can be mutagenic. And so the supporting tools that I'm sure you use in your patient population and that I use in mine are key. You have to always be looking at ways in which to optimize the functionality of the throughput of a number of different xenohormetic chemicals. And so when you're talking about this mutagenic form or this idea that we have these alterations in our DNA, our genetic predisposition to metabolize, it's been really well shown that this is the case. And I think one of the things that's been misunderstood out there is that estrogen's always been thought of because of the prepubertal and the pubescent elements of estrogen, meaning that they cause all these female sex characteristics to take place when we're going through puberty. We think that estrogen is basically a cell proliferative hormone. And what the research is now showing very clearly and has shown over probably the last 30 years is that when you have the inability to properly metabolize estrogen, it's actually damaging the DNA and it's creating the mutagenicity that's starting the cancer. See, cancer doesn't start the moment you see it on a mammogram. Cancer is a process. It's initiated and then propagated and then it starts to spread. So cancer is a process, and the process that kicks it off in breast tissue, prostate tissue, and even some neurodegenerative conditions as well, like Parkinson's, these same pathways are involved. starts at, you know, 20, 30 years before you actually get the diagnosis. And so having a good understanding of what you need to do to support your body's ability to take these estrogens and clear them and reduce exposure and to promote proper cellular health at the tissue level is absolutely key for surviving today's very complex environment. This environment that we live in today is the most complex as far as novel chemicals that we've ever been exposed to in the history of mankind. And so this this complexity has created a lot of opportunity to be exposed to intermediates, these biotransformed intermediates that can create problems in our bodies that might manifest as cancer or some other chronic condition that we don't want to deal with.
So one of the most important things I hear from what you've been sharing is the necessity to support this pathway that clears the estrogens and ensures that they get turned into the right form for all our health, for men, for women, women of all ages, women who've been dealing with chronic illnesses or cancers. We all need to understand this has to become, in my belief, a primary part of our protocol, things that we have to take on a daily basis to support our health. So what are some of your favorite strategies? And I think we should start talking about sulforaphanes and broccoli seed extract products, because this is what I've been looking into and I'm very excited about, and this is a topic that I know is also near and dear to your heart. So let's talk about one of the most powerful ways to support this estrogen metabolism.
Yeah, so if you look at if you just look at cancer in general and you look at the epidemiology associated with cancer, there's a clear indication that fruits and vegetables definitely promote a healthier outcome and less cancer. So we know that, right? That's an easy assumption to make, and it's an easy conclusion to make when you read the literature. And then when we dig down a little deeper, we start to look at hormonal-related cancers, and we start to look at things that are related to metabolism of xenohormetic compounds and hormone-like compounds and hormones in general, you can drill down a little deeper and you can start to say, well, what exactly and what foods seem to confer the greatest benefit for reducing risk and promoting proper metabolism of these compounds? And I think Johns Hopkins has done one of the best jobs at really taking this information and from very basic science then on up to, you know, clinical trials that they've ran over the course of the last 20 plus years. And what they've shown is that they knew that cruciferous vegetables, broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, and kale, had this clear benefit for people that consume the highest levels of it. So they knew that these people that would consume high levels of cruciferous vegetables would have less cancers, hormonal-related cancers, and they'd have a lot less other, like colon cancer, and there's some neuroprotective benefits, and there were a tremendous amount of benefits that they saw. So then they started looking at what was inside the actual cruciferous that might be conferring this. And as they started to look at this, they started to focus in on broccoli, because broccoli seemed to have the highest level of the glucosinolate, and they're called glucoraphanin. And without getting too technical, glucoraphanin is not found in all broccoli. In fact, there's over 80 varieties of broccoli. And people recognize this by looking at the broccoli and seeing how the florets are clumped together, tighter or maybe looser in some, and so that's a variety of broccoli that's different, one from the other. And they started digging into the broccoli and saying, hey, well, what's inside this broccoli that could be of benefit? And they couldn't find it in all the broccoli, so they started to investigate all the cultivars of broccoli, and they identified about five cultivars that had reproducible amounts, because they're trying to design a study. And they were looking for high levels of glucoraphanin, which is that active ingredient that seems to be doing all the heavy lifting and conferring all the benefits. So as they went through this process, they also understood that they were seeing variation even within those species of broccoli. So they went to a company that was very well-versed in growing broccoli, and they wanted them to start to create a cultivar of broccoli through pressure. You can put environmental pressures on plants that will cause them to express certain constituents that will allow them to have higher levels of the active components in the broccoli. And over the course of about 17 years, they developed their own unique strain of broccoli that had high levels of the glucoraphanin. Now, glucoraphanin, when you eat it, gets converted into sulforaphane if it has myrosinase in it. And myrosinase is a very key enzyme in the process of converting glucoraphanin to sulforaphane. And ultimately, sulforaphane is the active ingredient that confers all the health benefits and all the chemoprotective benefits in broccoli. But it has to be the right broccoli, it has to be the right enzyme, and it has to be enough of the glucoraphanin. So it gets kind of complicated when you start to think of, maybe I can just eat broccoli and get the benefit. And there's some rationale for that, because it's got fiber, which will help to also bind and eliminate certain hormones that get stuck in the intestines, and you can get rid of them that way. But the real magic, the real benefit, is getting a broccoli or a nutraceutical of some sort that has a high level of the glucoraphanin combined with myrosinase. And so you know that I'm the medical spokesperson for a company that actually has these products. So the reason I even got involved with them is because when we started doing testing for estrogen metabolism after we did thermography, breast thermography on these women, and we found that they had areas of heat signature that would indicate that there's cellular proliferation or there's some increased vascular elements that are taking place, which is the precursor for cancer. When we measured their estrogen metabolism and then put them on the sulforaphane-containing product, we saw significant reduction, not only in the thermography, but also we saw significant reduction and alteration in their ability to metabolize and excrete estrogen.
I was going to say, that's really, I mean, to have the evidence to see the results of what occurs when women would take the broccoli seed extract product. By the way, the product is called Vitalica. People want to know more information. It's certainly up on my website, What Women Must Know. It's what I've been using personally and in my practice now, because, as you explained so well, this is one of the most important nutraceuticals we can take to drive the metabolism of estrogen down the right pathway, reduce our risk, and also keep ourselves hormonally balanced for the long term, and absolutely be support for those people who've been diagnosed with estrogen-sensitive cancers, which are all driven by these more dangerous forms of estrogen. And we coming to the end of the show, but I absolutely want to tell people that there's a test called an estrogen metabolism test that is a very profound test for anyone who wants to see how well the liver is metabolizing estrogens, right? That is a urine test that predominantly urine, right? Do they do it as a blood spot test? I think it's still a urine test, right?
They can do it both ways, but I use first morning urine, and that's mm-hmm. the most convenient mm-hmm. way for my patient population to do it, and probably yours as well.
Yeah, so that's a test that you're incorporating in your practice because it'll let you know how well you're doing this proper metabolism. And then I always like my nutrigenomic testing, because we're going to see what we've inherited as tendencies to be inefficient in clearing estrogens, which gets people to really get serious and compliant about making these simple dietary changes and nutritional changes. It's not really a complicated or difficult or expensive process, but we need to know how to hit the nail on the head. You know, how do we really get in there and get the best job accomplished with the least amount of effort and time and money? So, you know, that's why I'm excited about this. And you know, your work is so inspiring because you have the evidence. You've been seeing this in your practice. You've been measuring it. You've been using thermography before and after to see the physiological changes. So, you know, you're really at the leading edge. Very, you know, it's very important work. Very important work. You know,
thank you.
I wish we had more time, but we're really at the end. I think the best website, if I'm correct, is drmichaelnelson.com. Is that the one you recommend for people to contact
drmichaelnelson.com, Sierra Tahoe Wellness.com, and then the product, I know you've got your, it's the new product that you're using, I think, is Vitalica Plus, right?
Right.
So Vitalica, I think there's a website, vitalicaplus.com, and then I'm sure there's a link on your site as well to get the product, and that's another resource for more information.
That's wonderful. Well, thank you, Dr. Michael Nelson, for being with us today. It's such a pleasure, and I'm just really very appreciative for the work you're doing and staying right there on the leading edge and helping to empower and educate us. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
And to all of you listening, oh gosh, isn't that great information? So thank you for joining me today for another great conversation. Remember, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.